be sharing with us in just a minute. I'd like to tell you something about him. He's a native of Georgia, a graduate of Georgia Southwestern College in America. Holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in journalism from the University of Georgia in Athens. Has studied at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. George Peabody College for Teachers in Nashville and the University of Tennessee. He was sports editor of the Dothan Eagle from 46 to 52. In 53, he became associate editor of Home the Board's department. Then was editor of
to talk first about more specifically, Baptist Sunday School Board. What I say applies generally, I think, to all religious market generally. Let me say one thing in the beginning about the religious market, as it's called in the trade. And the word here is good and encouraging as far as freelance writers are concerned. Almost none of the big slicks, so-called, that is the secular periodicals. I'm speaking of magazines such as Cosmopolitan and Esquire and what have you. Almost none of those periodicals today accept unsolicited manuscripts. Practically all of their writing is done either on assignment or through literary agents. And there's a saying in the trade that if you need a literary agent, you can't get one. And when you can get one, you don't need one. What they mean by that is the beginner trying to break in feels that he needs a literary agent to sort of help him get his foot in the door with publishers. But a literary agent is not interested in that kind of person, generally speaking, because, you know, he works on a commission basis, and that person is not a saleable product yet. But after you establish yourself and have a name, you know, and publishers are looking for you, then agents are looking for you also because they want a cut, you know, of what you're making on your writings. And therefore, you don't really need an agent. That's an exaggeration, but to some extent that's true. But the religious market is still open to the freelance writer. They receive unsolicited material, as it's called, and is really one of the few markets that's still open to that writer. But now, that's the good news. The bad news, of course, is that because the religious market is almost one of the few that's still open to the freelancer, the competition is a lot keener. Freelancers want to go to the big paying market, and I'll tell you more about the sad news about payment in the religious market. But the competition is keener. Well, first, curriculum writing, or lesson course writing. I'm speaking of all the age-graded materials in Sunday school, church training, the mission organizations, and their corresponding organizations and curriculums in nearly all of the denominations. That writing is done on assignment. And those writers' qualifications are, first, that they, as far as we're concerned, must be a Southern Baptist, a card-carrying Southern Baptist, and that's understandable. And, of course, they must have qualifications, training, whether formal or the equivalent of formal training, and some expertise and some writing ability. The normal course of selection and writing of curriculum, one thing that you need to keep in mind about curriculum writing is that it's done on a long-range basis. Part of the reason for this, one reason for the long schedule of production. For example, persons who are enlisted now to do curriculum writing will probably write for 84-85. That is the material that will be circulated into the churches in 84-85. One reason for that is that there are so many publications produced by the Sunday School Board, and they are produced on what's called a gang run. That is, many periodicals are put on the press at the same time. That's a money-saving measure, of course, but it stretches out the production schedule. So that's one reason for that long-range schedule. The other is, these writers are enlisted to write in their, quote, spare time. They write as a sideline. And, of course, a person who writes when he finds opportunity to work on a curriculum assignment apart from his regular vocation will not have the time to concentrate on it, generally speaking. So, in other words, if we had staff persons to do that kind of writing, they might, devote full time for a couple of weeks and knock out a unit of lessons. But a person who's doing it part-time is nearly all the curriculum writers are. It's going to take much longer. So normally a person will have 6 months, more or less, to develop a unit of materials, whether it's in the children's area or adults or somewhere in between. Well, how does an editor go about selecting these persons? Well, from his personal contacts and from word of mouth and also by reputation, he learns about persons who have skills in various areas and writes to those persons and seeks to enlist them to see whether they're interested and to enlist them to write. And if they are interested in writing, the next step is to have them come to Nashville for a writer's conference or orientation. That normally happens once a year, usually in the fall, and normally an editor will enlist writers to produce a year's curriculum. Say an editor is editing youth church training materials. He or she will enlist enough writers to produce a year's lesson courses. And they will, generally, they come to Nashville or to a state park or somewhere nearby where they can get together for concentrated conference and study. And during the course of that briefing, the editor and the writers talk about curriculum writing generally. That's usually where they start, with the general assignment. And then they gradually zero in until they get to, and then you have a one-on-one relationship between the editor and the writer dealing with your particular assignment. Ordinarily, an editor will list, say, two persons for a unit, and one will be developing the, say you're developing materials for the student and you for the teacher or leader, and after the general session, then an editor will confer with the two of you talking about that unit that you're developing jointly and how you two may need to stay in touch as you work. And then we'll have one-on-one conferences with each of you to talk about your particular assignment. That, then he gives you your assignment, you have your orientation, you know what your topic is. There are a number of givens in curriculum writing. Now, some writers don't like this at all. A lot of writers, you know, they feel that writing is a creative thing, and they want to be free, you know, to just create. And so that kind of writer will not be attracted to curriculum writing because it's very restrictive, very confining. It's literally pouring content into a mold. That's the best way I know of to describe curriculum writing. And your specifications that the editor will give you, for example, will be something like, give me 117 lines at 45 characters and spaces per line, 117 lines of introduction, and then 223 lines of content, and maybe 179 lines of teaching procedures. Very exacting, very confining. And then there are a number of other givens, such as the editor will give you the topic, of course, and the learning objectives, the teaching aim, those kind of specific guidelines, which are usually developed by an editor working with a group of consultants or advisors, and they will develop this outline, the objectives, the learning outcomes, teaching aims, so forth. A writer may participate in the development of that outline as well as write to it, but sometimes he will and sometimes not. But that's how those outlines are developed, and a number of givens are presented to the writer. He must write to very exacting specifications, and I say many writers just find this too cramping. It just cramps their style, and but other writers welcome that kind of guidance, and so this is for them. A person not only needs writing skills, and I think that's a primary qualification, is the ability to communicate through the printed word, and it's certainly different from the spoken word. There are many great preachers in our convention who can't write worth a fig, as we have discovered to our embarrassment sometimes. There are many professors who are great in a classroom, but they cannot write. And so it is the writing, the ability to communicate through the printed word is a definite must. And the person must have some knowledge, of course, of Southern Baptist polity and policy and practice, to know how we do things and don't do things, some knowledge of our doctrine and belief, certainly. And then some knowledge of that target audience. If a writer is writing for, say, preschoolers, he or she certainly must have some skills and practical ability in working with a preschooler in the setting in which that curriculum will be used. So it's a good idea for a writer, a would-be writer, to specialize in a given area, whether it be, say, children in Sunday school, or maybe youth in RAs, or what have you. So those are some of the prerequisites to writing curriculum. Now, I've indicated how an editor selects those persons whom he believes to be qualified, but what about a person out there who is interested in writing, but the editor hasn't discovered his talent? Well, certainly that person, and we hope that he or she will, initiate a contact. Editors make contact with writers to enlist them, but prospective writers can also initiate that contact. If you are interested, say you feel that you have qualifications, let's say for writing for youth and church training, a good procedure to follow would be to, you'd be familiar with the church training curriculum for youth. You'd look in the front of that periodical and find the editor's name there, and you would write to him or her and say, here are my qualifications, and I'm interested in writing for youth and church training. What about it? Well, that editor probably would respond by saying, glad to learn of this, and would you be interested in undertaking a sample writing assignment? And if you wrote back and said, yes, I would, then he or she would send you a sample writing assignment, and that would be typical of a writing assignment for youth in church training. And then when you submit that manuscript, it would be evaluated by the editor, and on the basis of that evaluation, he would say, yes, we can use you, or maybe he would respond, don't call us, we'll call you. But you could come back again sometime later and try again. You can't tell. Chances are there'd be another editor on the scene by then, and he or she might respond differently. Let me stop now and ask if there any question or comment about any phases of curriculum writing. I have already said more than you wanted to know. Yeah. Okay, I think that the expertise comes, one, with working with that age group. And if it is an age group, well, it would be. It'd be adults or some other age group. It's curriculum writing. It'd be some experience in working in the church with that age group in the setting in which that curriculum would be used. That would be one. Of course, you get a good background here in the seminary. That certainly would be a qualification. And the other has to do, of course, with writing, as you've already implied. I'm a firm believer that there's only one way to learn to write, and that's to write and write and write and rewrite. And
do you think that you might have been started out as a screenwriter to gain some sort of
Yes, yes. You're doing a great deal of writing here, of course, in the course of completing your seminary work. And this is training in writing. It's not the same kind of writing, of course. It's similar to curriculum writing. It's not as similar to non-curriculum. But it's training. Those skills will need to be further developed in all likelihood. I don't think there are many natural-born writers, so-called. I do think there is a great deal about writing that can't be taught, but it can be learned. And I think the way to learn is simply to keep writing, keep at it.
Well,
much like other skills. I think the only way to learn to be a good basketball player, you know, is just keep pitching it at that hook and so forth. And the same applies to writing. Yes, ma'am. If not currently, then certainly recently, because as you know, with some of those age groups, the methodology changes rapidly and they are constantly trying new approaches. So a person, if not currently working with that group, certainly ought to be up to date on methodology and familiar with the curriculum as it is presently. The editor of curriculum now with a given age group has his own or her own ideas about the best methodology and the best approaches to curriculum, and so a prospective writer ought to be familiar with that editor's approach if he or she is not working then with that age group and using the materials that editor is turning out for curriculum. Yes?
This is a more general question that I'm not sure about that, but what extent is practical experience considered, not just for curriculum writing, I'm not going to ask for but in most phases of religious writing and journalism,
quite a bit. The way that's usually described as a certain amount of formal training or the equivalent. And I say again, there's no substitute for the practical experience of writing as far as training to be a writer. And the fact that you've worked on a newspaper or a campus paper and have had the practical experience of writing, that's not to be challenged. That's good training and experience. It's not the same thing, again, as curriculum writing, but it is training in writing. And as far as practical results, it may surpass a course in journalism as far as equipping a person for the real test of writing, which is to have written. As the saying goes, there are a lot of people who want to have written, but there's a big difference between wanting to have written and writing. Hard work, as any of you know who've done any writing, but it's the only way to learn. Okay, let's move on to non-curriculum writing. Nearly all denominations and in the religious market, so-called, have their non-curriculum materials. Home Life, for example, is non-curriculum. We call it leisure reading at the Sunday School Board, and other denominations have their leisure reading or non-curriculum materials. Now, those periodicals are made up of basically of two kinds of materials. That done on assignment, and the unsolicited material. Now let's talk first about the assignment writing. Just about every editor, as I've indicated, has a committee or an advisory group that works with him or her. Let's say with one of the youth periodicals, that editor would have adults and youth, probably, who would be on a consulting team with him to plan that magazine and to evaluate it and to plot the course that it would take. With Home Life, we have an advisory group. It's made up of representatives from the age group sections because the family includes all ages. Also a representative from the Home Mission Board. And in that advisory group meeting, which we have about once a month, we'll plan content. We will brainstorm areas or topics that we won't feel ought to be treated in the magazine. For example, we'll say, you know, we ought to deal with subjects like abortion, and divorce and remarriage, and husband-wife roles and communication, all those things. So we'll say those are some topics that we ought to have in future issues. Now, who can we get to write those articles? And so we'll brainstorm article writers. Might be an MD who would write on human sexuality or abortion. Might be a lawyer, someone knows, who'd write on the legal aspects of marriage or family life. Or might be a pastor or a lay person who would write on something else. So those are enlisted usually by correspondence to say we'd like to have an article in an upcoming issue on this aspect of abortion. Would you develop an article of 2,000 words for us on this subject, and can you get it to us by the 1st of July? And so this would constitute a writing assignment. And that is assigned writing. All of the family worships and Bible study material, usually the ongoing material in the periodical, is done on assignment, such as the family worship and Bible study material. Those writers are enlisted similar to the curriculum writers and come for a writer's conference or orientation and a briefing, and then they complete their assignment. The article writing ordinarily will not be a conference, unless be informal, usually, for that kind of assignment. The other is the unsolicited material that I mentioned earlier. This is what trade calls the slush pile. It's not too flattering, or as they say, it comes in over the transom. Sometimes editors don't speak very flatteringly of the material that's received that way, but it really is the grist for our mills. And it does come in literally by the thousands. During the course of a year, Home Life will receive maybe 5,000 or 10,000 manuscripts of various kinds, fiction and nonfiction, prose and poetry, cartoons, all fillers, all the rest. And we'll use 10 to 20, 25 articles an issue each month. So you can see that the overwhelming percentage of that unsolicited material is returned, not accepted. No, normally that does not mean that it's not deserving of publication. For the most part, it's good, acceptable writing, but it just doesn't meet the competition. There's something else that's a little better. It's a little more pinpointed to our audience, and so that material is returned. The procedure there is, it's described in the writer's periodicals as SASE. That means stamped, self-addressed stamped envelope for reply, as the saying goes. That means that if your material is not accepted, the editor will put it in your self-addressed stamped envelope and return it to you with the rejection slip, expressing appreciation for that submission and encouraging you to try again, but saying that submission didn't quite hit the target. That's one way of submitting unsolicited material. That's submitting the manuscript itself. Again, I say the only way to learn to write is to write. What many writers do is they produce a manuscript, they have an idea, they produce
produce a manuscript for the religious market and they send it out on the rounds, as they say. And they'll try the more attractive markets or where they prefer to be published first and so on. If it doesn't get this one, then it comes back in that self-addressed stamped envelope and they send it out again. And on and on goes. And maybe they'll finally give up. Maybe finally it will be published. And that is often the case, usually the case if it's really a publishable manuscript. Sometimes it's simply a matter of hitting the right editor with the right article at the right time. It's altogether possible that a writer will submit a great manuscript or a good manuscript to an editor, but he feels that he's already done to death that subject for the time being. And, chances are, if that writer will submit it to two or three other editors, that it will hit sooner or later because it's basically a good manuscript. Now, the other method is the query letter. I discovered that that is not a familiar term. That's simply a letter. Rather than writing the manuscript, the writer will send the editor a query letter in which he describes his article idea, outlines it briefly, all this on one typewritten page. He gives the editor an idea of what he has in mind and how he plans to develop that article, and says, would you like to see such a manuscript? And the editor replies with, yes, if you want to submit that article on speculation, as the saying goes, which means that the editor is not committing himself to buy, but if the writer would like to submit the article on the chance that because the editor's interested, he might buy it, then he submits on speculation. With the hope that the editor will be interested or will like the product enough to buy. If he gets that favorable response, he produces the manuscript and submits it. If the editor says, no, I'm not interested, why, he produces another query letter and sends it to another editor until he finds someone who's interested in the article idea that he or she has in mind. So those are basically the approaches to non-curriculum writing for periodicals. They all say a word about payment. I said this was bad news, and it is. Payment at the Sunday School Board is 3.5 cents a word. Nobody gets rich writing for the religious market. That is the going rate. By that I mean that some religious publishers will pay a cent or a cent and a half a word. Some pay in copies of the magazine, the periodical. There are others who pay more, up to 10 cents a word, and maybe even 12, 15 cents, but not very many pay as well in the religious market. Why is that? Well, for one thing, most religious publishing houses are non-profit organizations. Anything they make above profit is channeled back into the denomination. That's the case with the Sunday School Board. It's channeled back to the churches through the state conventions. That's generally the way that flows. And then, two, it's recognized that these persons are not staff writers. They're not writing full-time. It's something they do as an avocation, part-time. And then, too, there's the idea of mission. We're really looking for people who want to make a contribution to the denomination and to our faith. through the medium of writing. So it's, nobody is attracted to the religious market because they want to make money, because there's just none there. None of the religious markets pay that well. Now, it is true that there are very few writers in the field, and I mean persons such as Billy Graham, David Mace, persons who are nationally known, basically Graham International. Their product would sell enough that they would get a good return. But that's the exception. Any question or comment now about non-curriculum writing and the process of submitting freelance material unsolicited, or being enlisted to write an article on assignment, that aspect of religious journalism. Yeah. Yes. Home Life, for example, and many of the so-called leisure reading or non-curriculum periodicals do use fiction. They don't use much, but they use some. Home Life would use more if we could get it. We get very little fiction or short stories that we feel are deserving of publication. I don't know why that is. Well, I do know one reason why that is. The short story market is almost vanished. Not many of the big slicks are publishing much short fiction today. So again, the person who wants to go into short story writing as a livelihood really doesn't have much of an avenue. There's not much hope there. There's a saying in the trade that it's impossible to publish a book of poetry that will sell, or to publish a recipe book that won't sell. Now that's an exaggeration, but I do think it says something about the readership in America, at least. American readers are looking for something that's practical and helpful, like a cookbook. And if you're talking about something that's inspirational, such as poetry, it doesn't do very well. Or it's not as true as far as something that's entertaining, such as a short story. But even there, the American reader seems to be much more interested, at least right now, in practical how-to help than he is in being entertained. Although, of course, the novels are doing very well, but short stories not nearly as well. We don't get many submissions at Home Life of short stories. And again, those that we do get, nearly all of them we return because they just don't ring the bell. If you're interested in short story writing, Christian fiction, up to 2,000 words, I would encourage, and of course it has to be, as far as Home Life is concerned, it has to deal with marriage and family related matters from a Christian perspective. And that's the kind of short story fiction that we're looking for. Yes, most periodicals do this. I think they have writer's guidelines. Our practice, when we send back a rejection slip with that manuscript that we return that we do not accept, we also enclose the writer's leaflet. You can write for Home Life, and it outlines our needs and suggests some approaches, and with the idea to encourage the writer to try again and look here in this leaflet. Maybe there's some ideas here that will stimulate you to to do something that we can use. And most periodicals do that. They'll also send a sample copy. There's no better way to, it's sort of beside the point to ask an editor, you know, well, what are you looking for? An editor basically is looking for publishable material that he thinks fits his market. And the best way to determine that from a writer's standpoint is to study the product. And if a writer wants to know what the editor of Home Life is looking for, what he needs to do is to study about a half a dozen issues of Home Life and see what's been published. And that's the best clue in the world to writing for Home Life or Saturday Evening Post or Christian Century or whatever. Well, Home Life's articles, I think, may be a little shorter than what is typical for the trade. That's because of our belief that readers are more and more pressured. They don't have much time. We think that's largely the success of the Reader's Digest. It's condensed writing. And we feel that most readers do their reading in snatches here and there, a minute or two. And so most of the articles in Home Life are, say, a one-page article is about 500 to 600 words, two pages, 1,000 to 1,200. And most of them are two pages. But rarely will an article in Home Life run longer than five. I would say that 2,500 words is about the outside limit for most of the religious market. Anything longer than 2,500 words, probably the editor will suggest that the writer trim it back. I think usually that would be his response to cut it back to 2,500 to 2,000 words. The writer's market is very good, and of course the writer, the literary marketplace is also a book that's in most libraries, and it will give you that information. The writer magazine and that other trade magazine, it used to be called Author and Writer. But anyhow, the Writer magazine, monthly, each month it carries a listing of markets. Say one issue it will be the religious market. It'll list hundreds or at least scores of periodicals in the religious market. Another month it will deal with the short story market or the poetry market. It'll list those periodicals that publish poetry. Another month, it'll be novels, and it'll list book publishers who are accepting novels of whatever kind. So that is the writer is and it's very up to date. You know, it comes out monthly, and so anytime you turn to that in a current issue and see a listing there, you can be reasonably certain that the editor listed there is indeed the current editor, and that the address is correct, and that periodical hasn't expired, and they do tend to come and go. Okay, let's move on to consider for a moment. I've been talking up to this point primarily about periodical publications. What about other publications in the religious market, books and related products, audiovisual? For your denomination,
the book publishers are Convention and Broadman. Convention Press and Broadman Press. Convention Press is really a curriculum. That's curriculum writing for the most part. And the same thing that I said about curriculum writing for periodicals generally would apply to writing for Convention Press. That is, it's done on assignment. It's done by Southern Baptist writers. They are enlisted and given an orientation, a briefing. The usual course there is that a writer will be enlisted and the editor will give him a rough outline, a framework for a book idea that's been developed either by the editor or the editor in consultation with other persons. And they will say, here's the broad outline of framework. You fill this in, say, with a, give us a chapter outline as to how you would develop this book idea. So that writer who's been enlisted develops a chapter outline for this Convention Press book, which he in turn submits to the editor, and the editor and others evaluate that outline and say, okay, go ahead, but when you get to chapter 7, instead of treating it the way you had planned to do this, you know, in other words, some adjustment there, he goes ahead with his manuscript. That's with Convention. Broadman Press enlists writers to write, and it also accepts unsolicited manuscripts. That is, either the editor can initiate a book idea or the writer can initiate. And a great deal of that is done from both ends. That is, there are a number of writers, and they're not all of them are Southern Baptists. They don't have to be to write for Broadman. They do to write for Convention, because Convention is being two Southern Baptists designed for use primarily in the churches, but that's not the case with Broadman Press. And writers can initiate a contact. What they usually do is the query letter. Send the editor a query letter, and normally that will include at least a chapter outline. Here's my book idea, and it may be fiction or nonfiction. Of course, they publish much more nonfiction than fiction, a few novels. Usually, though, of course, Broadman publishes nonfiction. What Broadman wants is for the writer not only to develop an outline, but to pinpoint the audience. And that's very important. A lot of freelance writers overlook that. What a beginning writer tends to do is to say, well, what do you mean, audience? This book is for everybody. Well, when a writer says that, the publisher immediately tends to back off, because he knows hardly anybody has ever written a book that's for everybody. You know, the Bible isn't for everybody. Well, it's for everybody, but I mean not everybody reads it. Although it's the bestseller and the most widely read, not everybody reads the Bible, and not everybody is going to read your book, no matter how great it is. It may be the great American novel that we've all been waiting for all these centuries, but chances are it isn't. And that's not a selling point to tell a publisher, you know, this book is for everybody. A much better selling point is to say, this book that I have in mind is to give pastors practical help in how to do premarital counseling. Here's a book that will, I plan to develop 10 chapters, and it's really 10 steps for a pastor in doing pastoral counseling with for premarital. That's a target audience. It's pastors, that's a specific group, and it's to enable them to do a specific task. Now, that's not everybody, but chances are when a pastor walks into a bookstore and he's looking for some help
and how to do premarital counseling. He sees that book, he'll pick it up. He may not buy it, but he will pick it up. And he'll look at it, and if he thinks it'll help him, he may invest. And of course, I'm going to have to tell you, the books are getting very expensive. So when before somebody shells out $9.95 or $19.95, they want to make sure that's what they is going to be worth it, what they plump down. Or an editor can enlist a writer to do the same, say the same, let's say the same book. And they'd seek out somebody. Bob Dale was just in here. So he began, he might seek out a person like Bob Dale to do that book. Someone else. Again, payment. It's bad news. Let me say again, nobody gets rich writing for the religious market. Our time's gone, so I'll conclude. It's on a commission basis. 10% of royalties. Broadman has to sell about 5,000 copies to break even. 10,000 copies would be a good seller for Broadman, not a best seller. But usually, anybody, it would be a name like Jack Taylor or Herschel Hobbs, somebody like that, usually could sell more than 10,000 copies. So figure 10% of whatever that book sells for, $5.95, and you get an idea of how much that writer's going to get. One other thing I'll say, it's different from that, and that's the Broadman Reader's Plan. When the editor at Broadman decides that a book's going into the Broadman Reader's Plan, that is a flat fee, not a fat fee, but a flat fee. And I'm sure you'll agree when I tell you that fee is about $1,350 for the manuscript. And that's about all that you will get as a writer, except that if it's put in the bookstore for individual sales, you'd also get 10% of royalties on that. But those books, you know, they caught the bulk of their market through the Broadman Reader's Plan. So normally those books don't do very well beyond that. Not unless they live for a number of years. And Broadman tends to GOP, that is, take a book out of print. Very soon after publication, a year or two, unless sales are really going to be. Any concluding question or comment from anyone? Yes. A non-print medium? Okay. Audiovisual, that arrangement is similar. That is, that's done by Broadman, and Broadman will enlist persons to develop a script, or a person to initiate that contact, say, here's my idea for a script or an audiovisual or a cassette, and they will come up with that idea. I'll say a word about contract. The copyright laws have changed so drastically since 1978 until we have been forced, our attorneys have advised us, to have a contract with all writers now. Usually what they do is they sign an agreement that they're selling all rights to a manuscript to the Tennessee Board. Now, a writer can sell first right only, but the board prefers to buy all rights, and that's done through a contract arrangement. The Broadman Press has always done that. That is, their book authors will sign a contract that they'll accept 10% of royalties as payment for their manuscript. Okay, time's up. I appreciate your interest and attention. I'll be here to...